hear your names. Mr. Brown, Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the movie calendar. My name is Lee.
My name's Terrence.
And this week we kick off our Director December, our first one all about Quentin Tarantino, and we are beginning at the beginning with Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to talk about this movie.
I did that just to give time for the title thing to come up in the
Ah, yes, we're doing graphics and stuff now.
Yeah.
That's fun.
And now that that's gone, ba-ba, how long has that been in there?
I've had that poster in the back of the movie cowl since Parasite episode, since episode one. I have owned that Reservoir Dogs poster. For those of you joining us on your favorite podcast app of choice, welcome, hello. We do have a YouTube version as well, which is what we're referencing here on the set that we have. Set. Wow, that's a...
It's a set.
Yeah, it's kind of. my spare bedroom. And I have a poster here that I picked up at a flea market, like... probably 15 years ago.
50 years ago?
50 years ago,
at a shop that just sells fleas.
It was way ahead of its time.
I'll just stop. Yes.
Yeah, we're normally a lot funnier than that. Please don't leave just yet.
Little teasers into Tarantino's... am I saying... No, the Director December.
Yeah, yes. We have. Over the last four First weeks, film. We have been trickling out little clues as to what we're going to do, and we announced it. On the last episode, as you know, because everyone checked out the Goonies episode, that we announced Quentin Tarantino was going to be the subject of the first Director December for the movie calendar. Mm. And we had a discussion as to where we were going to start, and Reservoir Dogs seemed like an awesome place.
Start at the beginning.
Yep.
So we've already announced the four films we're going to do.
We have, yeah, that was in the end of the episode. We'll announce it again at the end of this one. There's time codes in the description below if you'd like to jump around. We're going to be getting into the plot of the film, just the style... I've got it written down here. Dialogue and the violence, and talking about Quentin Tarantino himself on the lead up to making this movie, and a little bit after, and then we'll go into our regular scheduled programming of our hashtag What About Wens, adding the film to the movie calendar, and then announcing the films after that. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, we haven't decided what we're doing for January yet. It's not a themed month. We can do any films under the sun. If you have any suggestions, please let us know what they are. We have a list of films that we want to do, but if you have anything, let us know on Twitter or Instagram, or send us an email. Links to all of the socials are down in the description below. We are at The Movie Cal everywhere. TheMovieCal@gmail.com is the email. You can find them all on the website, themoviecalendar.com.
Wow, you didn't take a breath from like all of that. I was thinking, oh, I can do some socials here and I can... Nope.
Sorry.
Nailed it. You got it.
I'm very excited.
What he said.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm a Tarantino fan, but not compared to this person next to me. So I might turn the mic off at some point.
No.
I might disappear. I'll put a cut out of myself here. You will take the reins on this, I would imagine. So I haven't watched the film. What's it like?
Well, I'll tell you what. We should organize some kind of visual cue that I can give you to just go and make a cup of tea and pop on back.
What would be your synopsis of this film?
This film is about six strangers, criminals, who band together or get recruited to pull off a heist, a diamond heist, but they couldn't have imagined how horrible it would go.
Wow. You know, when you say it like that, okay, you added criminals and diamond heist. It almost sounded like the plot for the Goonies, except for these people don't know each other. But, you know, Goonies was this group of kids that come together. They don't know each other.
They know each other. That is the whole plot of the Goonies.
They're all like rejects of society. So they're random. And they go to do a big rich stuff heist. They go to steal the treasure.
You don't need to link every episode to another episode.
I do. It's how I live.
Oh my God.
How I link movies to other movies.
There are so many other movies that you could link this film to. Considering the cultural impact this film has and some of the movies that we've talked about.
I think that was a direct link.
Yeah,
directly. Okay. I'm pretty sure Tarantino met with Spielberg and worked it out and said, you know what, I want to do something like this in homage to you.
Yeah, in homage to the Goonies, he made Reservoir Dogs.
Bit of violence.
Yeah.
Let's bring it into the city.
But this film is incredible. Like, ahead of its time doesn't even describe it well enough. Like, it's It changed cinema forever. There's quotes from critics that talk about when this film premiered at Sundance, where it was like that moment where there's a film, I don't remember the name because it's got a, I think that it's French and I can't pronounce it, so I won't try. I think it's in 1895 or maybe earlier. It's the first scene. Have you seen the train coming up into the station? Are you aware of this film? It's the first ever recorded. Have you seen it? Do you know of it?
Of film?
Yes.
Yes.
So they showed an audience just a train, the film of a train coming into the station, and people ducked and ran out of the theater. They thought that there was a train coming for them. People have said that watching this film premiere at Sundance was equivalent to that moment for cinema.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I also know that the Fred Ott sneeze is the first recorded thing in history, just by the way, in case people come at me in the mentions.
Yeah, that was the first video photo style thing, right? But the train, I've seen the train.
Yeah, so the train, people like running away from the screen thinking that a train was pulling into the station. Yeah, so it has been compared to that. I obviously wasn't there. Obviously, I would have been like 4 years old. But yeah, what a moment in history to be a part of. This film just changed the game for everyone. We are going to get into all of that. I recommend that we start with the style of the film.
Okay.
Because it oozes cool. Any other housekeeping before we get started? We should mention...
Spoilers.
Spoilers ahead. We are going to be talking about the film as if you have seen it. So if you haven't, give it a watch. It is well worth your time. Bit of violence, a lot of swearing, a lot of blood. But if you can stomach it, this one is an absolute must watch. You'd know by now whether you want to watch a Tarantino film or not.
Yeah.
If you don't, if you just want to join us on this ride, that's absolutely fine too. But spoilers ahead.
Spoilers everywhere. You don't want to spoil this. If you haven't seen it yet, don't spoil it. Go watch it first.
Yeah. Incredible.
And let this video run in the background so we get a couple of counts up and then go watch it and then come back and watch this again. Yes. This set the tone for Tarantino, right? This was kind of...
For cinema.
Wow.
And for people outside of cinema. Like, people started dressing like these characters. Like, the cultural impact that this had just on society in general, especially in the UK.
Yeah.
This film was massive in the in England.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not too sure. There was just something about it that just spread like wildfire. There's probably a couple of reasons. One, it was released in the UK after its release at Sundance and Cannes, and it did its festivals. Then it went there and it stayed in the cinemas for quite some time, and then it left and didn't get a home release until 95, so years later. So in 1994, they re-released it in cinemas again because people were still wanting to see it again and again. And kids started dressing with the skinny black tie. Yeah. And there was just something about this film's style that just hit home for a generation of people.
Yeah, it was very different for everyone, for every audience. And I guess quite a fresh take on storytelling, not to mention the shooting styles and the angles, the dialogue, like the everything.
Dialogue we'll talk about.
Would have inspired so many filmmakers and so many people to think, you know what, I can do this. It's not always about a setup scene where you expect this close-up shot. You can do things differently.
Yeah,
and very little. You can be violent. You can be graphic.
Yes.
And artistic.
Very little close-ups. There's a lot of real wide shots to let the scenes breathe, let the actors have their moments, let the violence have its impact, right? Which I'll talk about in a minute. But a lot of really long takes in this film
just to
allow these moments and these scenes to breathe. But then, just mixing it up with how it's shot. Like, the diner scene is a classic example. Like, opening this film with this, like, camera rotating around the table, almost like a voyeur into this conversation, listening to these just human beings have a conversation about things that they're passionate about, things they care about, things that they have a strong knowledge base in. Like, Tarantino was able to write this incredible dialogue that just naturally flows off the tongue. That if you get it right, it's so conversational, and he tapped into something where, you know, when people talk about their passions, kind of like what I'm doing now, where they have this kind of rhythm to it, like he was able to write it down. It wasn't dialogue, it was talking.
Wow, very interesting.
Or conversation.
I think that kind of writing has been finessed over the years, because when I was watching this, I thought it seemed a bit contrived, in all honesty, as hurtful as that might sound to you, but it really did.
And it might now, looking back on a 30 yeah, years ago well, lens.
Now it actually does to me as well, but I see it with the filter of what it's done for film. So, you know, there are things that can be dated, that's fine. I'm not a big fan of Tarantino's acting.
Oh no, he's a terrible actor.
And I
hate I'll be the first to admit
and
that.
I hate that he was the main player in the scene, especially the opening of it, but you're allowed to have your day. You make the film.
Yeah.
You go for it.
Yeah.
You know? And it was great. It was a great part.
it could have been worse. So he was originally supposed to play Mr. Pink's character.
Oh, I'm so glad he played the character he did.
So that Madonna thing was supposed to be done by Mr. Pink, but when he cast Steve Buscemi, he was like, oh, like I want to do something. So he gave that to Mr. Brown instead, so that he could play Mr. Brown.
Yeah.
There's a really cool story, and I guess while we're here, I'll go into it as to how he ended up not playing Mr. Pink. It was during the auditions, Steve Buscemi came in to read for Mr. White, and he's like, oh, I really like the character of Mr. Pink. And Tarantino was like, well, you're gonna have to smash out your audition in order to get that role away from me. And Steve Buscemi delivered.
And he did.
Yeah. Which kind of, like, people say that Tarantino's got this massive ego, and, you know, because he's like a god of what he does. Like, you can't touch a line of dialogue in a script. And, like, a lot of that is kind of true. But then he also has the ability to look outside of himself to be like, no, this person is going to be better at this and do it. And for a first film as well, to be able to do that is incredible. Like, he knew that this would make the film better, and he went with it.
Maybe that's the reason he was able to do it, because it was his first
direct, he still does it though.
Not his first directorial debut, but his full film, right? This is the first full film he directed.
First feature film.
And wrote.
So he wrote a bunch of us. We're gonna talk about Tarantino towards the end before we go into What About When. So I might hold off on a few of those while we'll stick with talking about the style of the film first, and we'll get into there. Otherwise, if we don't have a structure, this is just gonna go everywhere. And you'll know by now how long the runtime of this episode is. We're gonna try and keep it short. Hopefully will be around the hour and a half mark, but or earlier or later, we'll find out. But yeah, the style, even the way that the story was structured, that non-linear storytelling, like, it's a heist film,
where but you don't
see the heist.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, so before the record, I was telling Lee that up until I rewatched this film, which was a number of nights ago, I had this visual in my head, because it had been years since I'd seen it. I had a visual of the heist happening, specifically where a manager's finger gets cut off. And of course, realizing this, that's Harvey Keitel's scene where he has this great monologue about how to be threatening and
how to deal with people who are giving you pushback.
How to deal with that. And I'm like, hang on. As he was talking, saying that
this
line,
this never happens.
Oh my God, you don't see the heist. That's amazing.
Yeah.
You
incredible.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. Like, and there was practical reasons for there not to be a heist shown, because the reason Tarantino was said in interviews, the reason why there's no heist in the script is because they didn't have the budget to film one. So they just had to write around it. And then later on, as he was sort of going to the final script development, he's like, oh no, this is actually really cool, because it plays out in your mind then. Which I think is really
a
stunning piece of writing, of showing the before.
Yeah.
And that, like, the planning and the aftermath of the heist itself, but never actually showing it go down. But it paints such a strong picture of what happens. Like, I know what happens in that jewelry store, even though we don't see a frame of action from there.
Oh, well, they explain it all.
Exactly.
You don't need to show it. When the characters are going to talk about it anyway,
yeah,
that's when it becomes patronizing.
Yeah.
So don't show it. They're going to talk about it.
Yeah. Also, the, like, sticking with style, this is the last point I have for style, and then we'll move on to onto dialogue, which we've already tapped into a little bit. All of the cultural references in the film wasn't something that was the norm for characters to speak about.
Normally, what do you mean, cultural references?
Like talking film? About
Madonna.
Yeah. Or, you know, I was going to say Jackie Brown, Pam Grier. Like, all of the the way that they talk about music and how they're listening to this radio station who's doing a 70s throwback time, and they're all loving it and having a great time. Oh, the music.
Well, that into the style of it, you know, what a great technique to actually have the entire score only be music that you actually hear in the film.
Yeah, I was wondering if you picked up on that.
To tie it in, to have them talk in initial scene of, hey, how good is this radio station? So they all get it in their head and you know that they're all listening to that radio station. So what a great way to make it so that all the songs you love are going to be in this film. Make all your characters love the music and have a radio available everywhere. Lots of car stuff.
Yeah, lots of driving around. Tarantino loves his driving.
A random radio in a mortuary warehouse loading dock. Let's put a radio there so we can do some cool stuff there that we are going to talk about.
But yeah, no score, which is amazing. The fact that all of the music in the film is actual music is just such a Tarantino thing to do.
Yeah. Is that... I mentioned it ages ago. Diegetic? That's diegetic sound. Or non-diegetic sound.
No, there's some of the music just plays. It'll be like someone will...
You hear it in the background.
So you'll hear a song like Hooked on a Feeling, Blue Swede will come on. And it's playing in the film.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to Mr. White and Mr. Orange in the car. And then you hear it really faint and they're listening to it on the radio.
But so it's on the radio. So they kind blend of
both.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. So it works both.
Mm. It's very... So yes, I did pick up on that.
Yeah. Awesome style. Brilliant techniques.
Yeah.
Just all the way through, making this just one of the coolest films. And it was the coolest film ever made at the time that it came out.
Oh, yeah. And it would have held that title for many
years. Well, until his next film came out.
Do we see
I've got a poster behind me. Can you see it?
We won't mention it in case you can't see it, but we might.
Yeah, no, sorry. There's a for people listening. In case you can't see it, there's a poster of Pulp Fiction behind me.
It's off to the side, so we kind of have to move a bit to see it. Yeah. Okay, but getting old. You're talking about how young you are with how old you are when you see it. Now you hurt your back.
Yeah.
No excuses.
I got a bad back anyway.
There was with that style. You mentioned long shots and shooting wide. You know, you don't need to do close-ups. It's the same with the music. You know, long spanses of no score. It's okay. Silence is all right.
Yeah.
You know?
Be comfortable with the quiet.
And it's not quiet. It's never quiet. You hear cars in the background. You can hear people walking. It's be comfortable with that. And that's where people, I think, fell in love with this. It was so different. And no one really could put their finger on it.
Yeah.
Until afterwards when you analyze
it. It's like I don't know why, but this was just a transcendent experience.
Yeah. It was so real.
Yeah. It's awesome. Dialogue.
Yeah.
So pithy. And everything flows so naturally.
What's pithy? What do you mean pithy?
Sounds like a good word. Don't call me up on that. You've never heard that before.
I'm thinking, I haven't really heard that being mentioned.
Yeah, look it up. I'm teaching. I'm changing minds. It's just everything flows so well, and it's so sharp and witty.
Yeah.
And he's got... it's not witty for the sake of it being witty. It's all character driven. Like Tarantino has obviously come up with a backstory for every single character in his film, and he knows what they love and what they hate, you know, what their interests are, what music they listen to, what movies they love, and he's just...
What their values are.
Exactly, and he's just put it all in the film, and it makes the interactions between them just so organic. Like, that's how people speak.
Yeah.
Like, they don't talk about their family all the time or the problems that they're having. Like, they're talking about music and movies and interrupting each other. One person's looking through an old address book that he's got and he can't figure it out, and he's not part of this conversation, and it's overlapping dialogue and losing your train of thought. And like, it's all so real. But yet, like, the language dances in this film out of the actors' mouths is probably the best way I can say it. It's like a play.
I'm so glad you said it like that, because that's exactly how I feel this played out. Specific scene. Whenever they're in the warehouse, that's almost like it's a play.
It could be.
You see a play appear on a stage, and they've got a very basic set. That's what this felt like.
I would love to see a Reservoir Dogs musical.
Oh, man.
That would be amazing. Lin-Manuel Miranda, get on that soon.
Yeah, but don't write music. Don't write any songs for it. Just do it as it is.
No, you do never Tell Lin-Manuel Miranda not to write music. Excuse me.
I didn't tell him.
And thank you. That is enough. Him. Wow.
I'm just saying it doesn't need...
That's like telling him not to breathe, Terrence.
Sorry, Lin. That's not what I meant.
No, it's fine.
This, I could see this being done, you know, believe it or not, I could see it being done in like a high school for a drama class or something.
Yeah.
As a study.
And then wrecking it completely.
Yeah, but that's what they could do in high school. It's fine. But every scene could have been done like that. Every one of them seemed like it was acted out like that. And a lot of it was due to the wide angle because you always see everything in the shot.
Yeah.
There was never this close up in your face. I need to get the emotion on this person. No, you understood it all from their quality of acting. You understood it from their stage presence. You understood it from the way they held themselves and the way they interacted with each other. They were each so individual, but they were allowed to express that. And to be able to feel that about a film, I thought was pretty impressive. It totally took me away from the fact that I was watching it on a television.
Yeah.
I actually felt like the realism, right?
Yeah.
The dialogue helped so much with that.
Yeah, you get so encapsulated in this world.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Hateful Eight?
No.
So, I've got another thing for The Hateful Eight there. God, that was so much fun, that experience. I'll probably talk about that at some point. That film is like a play. It's all set in the one location. Oh. All the characters are like snow blizzarded in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could absolutely be a play.
Another one by Grade 12.
Yeah, maybe not that one.
Okay, I haven't seen it. If I said it and I offended people, I would not have said that.
No, it's fine.
That's
it's not my favorite Tarantino film, but yeah, it's a very Tarantino movie. So if you're into his style, like, it's just full of it.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. I was going to say something. Oh, pithy.
Yes. Ready? Oh, you looked it up?
Yeah, pithy. Here we go. This will clear everything up. Containing much pith. So, yeah, I agree. That's one of the things.
That's what I meant.
Succinct.
Ah, nice.
Succinct or terse and vigorously expressive.
Oh, that one. Not succinct. That one. That is the definition.
Containing
that I was
much
with.
Pith.
I was like, you said succinct, and I was like, oh no, this is not pithy at all. This film is not succinct. This film is long. It's broad.
No, but the dialogue is succinct.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the bit I was impressed with. Okay, the whole thing was great, but I like how Mr. Pink, our Steve Buscemi's character, defends his opinion to not tip.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, yeah, because I've always, being in Australia, it's not a custom to just tip. It actually,
we don't tip.
I totally side with him.
Yeah.
And many people in Australia would. But it's a total reflection on the job system in the States, like how little they value their workers.
Yeah.
To have minimum wage so low that it's a disgusting thing that people are forced to work like that.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a total sad commentary on society over there, right? Sorry. But, you know.
apologies to the United States of America.
But yeah, in Australia, obviously, we're lucky enough that the minimum wage is actually livable.
Yep.
And you don't rely on the kindness of strangers donating
to live
money so you can pay your rent. That's why, that's,
yep.
That's, yeah, so.
Yeah, we shouldn't really compare. But
no, but his argument was amazing.
We also don't have a broken healthcare system, so we win.
his argument was amazing, and his ability to stand up for it and explain it was great.
All of the characters are so different and have like different education levels, and like Steve Buscemi's character, Mr. Pink, is just, he is the smartest one in the room. He's not the most confident. He's a bit unsure of himself. He's not a leader, but he is. He knows what's up. He can look into a situation, analyze it, figure out what's going on, and
very
then
logical.
Make decisions. Yes.
Yeah.
Like as soon as he comes into that warehouse and he's like, was that a setup or what?
Yeah.
Like, he knows.
Yeah.
He knows that something's happened. He's put it together already.
Yeah.
And yeah, that scene in the diner of him talking about tipping is just
absolutely
incredible.
And
we just had a dog enter the room, by the way.
He is the smartest, in case
you see him.
He's the most logical. Like, even when Mr. White is about to say, you know, enough of this stupid Mr. White, Mr. Pink stuff.
It's like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah.
Don't tell me your name. I'm not going to tell you mine.
Yeah. It's good. That was a moment where you realize, okay,
so
this is how we play.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, the dialogue. Tarantino also tests his dialogue in the film as well, which sounds very vague, but I'll explain what I mean. Where if dialogue isn't natural, then there are consequences.
For who?
So, in the characters in the film, I'm talking about Mr. Orange.
Yeah.
With the, specifically about the commode story.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to figure out what the commode story is and why it's important. And his boss, I'm guessing it's his boss that he meets in the diner.
Yep.
Like the detective tells him guy. That you, like, if you nail this story, if you can get your dialogue around this character perfect, you're in. Also, if you don't, if you do it poorly, you're going to get killed. So the importance of dialogue, even within the film itself, with the character of Mr. Orange, is it has to be perfect. And I feel that's the kind of attention to detail of the performances that Tarantino is looking for. And that, well, that's my take on it anyway. Like, he understands the importance of really good dialogue.
Yeah.
Because if it doesn't work, it dies.
I always like films that have acting within a movie.
Yeah.
Because that character gets to play two roles.
Tim Roth crushes this film. And
watching Tim Roth, watching him go through that conversation with his boss, his energy, his excitement, his adrenaline, he's so excited he's in, and then seeing him being turned into a child trying to learn these lines.
Yeah.
Like, he's rehearsing a project that he has to deliver.
Walking back over to the script and reading it. He's like reading it as if... He's reading it for the first time.
He's
and
learning this thing.
Listening to him tell the story to his boss. Like, where he's doing the show, the performance of it. And he's still... He's very wooden and he's acting it up. And he's like talking like a criminal would in a movie or a TV show. And then you see him in the bar and he's telling the story and it's
so good.
Way more natural.
So good.
Yeah. That performance is so hard to do. And yeah, Tim Roth just crushes it.
Yeah. We spoke about in another film about whether a phrase was coined in that film or
yes.
not. Now,
we did.
There's a phrase in this film. Actually, there are two great lines in the opening scene.
Yep.
One of them, you might pick the one that I'm going to ask. Yes. Okay, what's this?
Yeah.
So, I've heard that in different iterations.
For those of you listening, I just rubbed my thumb and my pointer finger together as if to say, what's this?
World's smallest violin playing for that
just for waitress. The waitresses.
Just for the waitresses. So, I've heard that, you know, what's this smallest violin playing for you or whatever it is. So, I wonder if Tarantino was the mind in that. I don't know.
I'd like to think so. I don't know that for sure.
Why not? But that was pretty cool. And watching it again now, I'm like, when he does that, you know, he takes this pose and starts doing that motion, I thought, oh, no, no. I can't think of a reference earlier than this. And the other one was same scene happening earlier than that when Harvey Keitel, when Mr. White snatches the book out of Joe's hands and they have some back and forth. And someone says, someone shoot this guy. And I think it's Mr. Blonde.
Yeah.
And he picks up the gun.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he pretends.
No, he says...
What does he say? I'll shoot him.
He says, Joe, you want me to shoot this guy for you?
Yeah.
And Mr. White...
You probably not word for
I know,
word.
Yeah, yeah. You shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize.
Ah, that was so good. And that gave... That gave me so much respect for Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Even more.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
Or you're gonna have more respect for Harvey Keitel when I finish this episode telling you how much influence he actually had in this film. If you don't know, people will, but there'll be a bunch of people listening or watching that don't. And if Harvey Keitel doesn't get this script, this movie doesn't happen.
Ooh.
Yeah. So a little tantalizing bit. We'll put that in the Tarantino section.
He has great lines in that opening scene. And then also in the scene once they arrive at the warehouse and Mr. Pink comes in. And they have that incredible scene where the two of them are kind of they're washing up in the bathroom. And it's a long shot just down the corridor, single shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, even things like, here, I'll get you a smoke, and he doesn't have them on him and he walks out of the room. You always wonder, like, was that meant to happen? Surely he would have had smokes on him. He would have just got him more. Did they even say in the script to get him a smoke or clicking to light the Zippo many times not working? Got it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I love that.
And then he got it. But yeah, for all I know, for all I know, you're the rat. For all I know, you're the rat. Finally, now you're using your head.
So good.
Yeah, incredible.
So good.
Amazing. So that, yeah, that might, we'll cap off dialogue there. Good, this, we're clicking through this. This is, it's great.
Really in control, this episode. Look at this.
Let's talk violence.
Okay. Let's talk violence.
Yes, let's not be violent. It's not that kind of podcast. We can, yeah, we'll talk about
violent. Okay.
Talk about the violence in this film, because
I can't be violent.
I think, yeah, sorry, in my house.
Look at these arms.
I think a lot of people see this film and don't really understand that the violence has a purpose. And they just think that it's violence for the sake of violence, and it's just gratuitous for the sake of being gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And I can completely understand why you would think that and how you see it like that. I get it, because there is a lot in this film. But it also shows consequences. Like, this film doesn't show any violence without consequence. Like, the fact that we see Mr. Orange lying on a floor, dying for essentially the entire film, or the opening shot of him after the diner where he's just in the car and screaming like a child looking for his mother lost in a supermarket is horrific to watch. It's not just there for the sake of being there.
They do, you're right, they actually show the pain involved with violent trauma, or at least, you know, I'm lucky enough to not have seen anything like that in real life. But there's no heroism or silent, oh, I've been shot and I'm bleeding out.
Yeah. Well, there's no, that's like, a lot, you know, like, oh, cutting off someone's arm and then, oh, and blood spraying out. Yeah. Like, that happens in Kill Bill.
But with purpose.
It's stylized, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's supposed to be stylized. But it happens, like, horror movies all the time will show people getting limbs cut off and
it's
disemboweled and stuff. And it's literally for shock. Shock value. Like, there's no purpose for it.
Yeah.
Other than to make everyone go, ew, gross. Whereas this one, I think it's supposed to show you how horrible it is.
Yeah. And it does a good job of it. And you're right. It's got consequence.
He also shows a lot of restraint, Tarantino, with the violence in this film. Like, the cutting of the ear, you don't actually see. They had originally shot it of watching it get cut off.
Yeah.
And then they did the other one where they just pan away from it, don't see it, let it happen off screen.
Yeah.
And I think it's so much more effective that way. Like, he knows when to hold back. Also, again, we don't see the heist. And the heist is apparently a massacre.
Yep.
Like, so many people get shot. At least four of the employees plus the manager all get shot by Mr. Blonde, just massacring people. So we don't see any of that.
We have a description of someone who's quite young as well. So
how old would that girl have been?
He's maybe shot a child.
Yeah.
You know, well, child, someone 21, if that, right? Yeah. So it could be a 17, 18-year-old.
That's a child.
Yeah.
So you don't see it, and all, it all has purpose.
Yeah. You do see a couple, but you're right, they have purpose. They're necessary for the story.
And the scenes that are disturbing are designed to be disturbing. Like, you are supposed to feel that. Like when the ear does happen, or when you see it for the first time, when Mr. Blonde is throwing the petrol on the police officer, and you see the ear for the first time and that's been hacked off. Like, it's, you are supposed to feel shocked. The person who did the makeup, I think I read this right. The person who did the makeup for the ear is the same person who did the Freddy Krueger makeup, I think. And Tarantino was talking to him after a couple of the screenings that he went to see, and people would leave the theater during that ear scene.
Why would you leave a theater?
Because
in the height of, like, this activity,
because you're like, this is gross. I'm out of here. I don't need to be a part of this. Like, I understand. I get it. And the makeup artist went to Tarantino and said, "It's a compliment. Only think of it as a compliment. You designed it to be disturbing. You literally just got exactly what you were trying to do."
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, that's all I have to say about the violence.
I like that we actually saw the ear.
Yeah.
I was surprised that we saw it.
Mm.
You know, it was clear already. They painted Mr. Blonde as a psycho. You know, they did that with talking about numerous times how he just went nuts. He just started shooting people. He's shooting children. Oh my God, he's a psychopath. He comes in. They say he's a psychopath. I don't want him here.
Absolute
great
psychopath.
So when the camera pans away, you know what he's doing. It's not unbelievable at all. He has a cutthroat razor. You know these things are sharp. Okay, cool. I just wanted to see it. As a viewer, I just wanted to see it. Which I'm sure a lot of other people were like that as well. Cut away, and I was like, man, we don't see anything. We didn't see anyone get shot. We saw the blood.
Yeah. It's okay. And that's the thing about the scene, right? It's not about that. It's not about that at all.
No.
It's just showing the consequences of it.
And it was satisfying to see it. Honestly, it was, because there was curiosity there. And I still don't know if that's what it would really look like.
Oh, probably
not. I guess
they had
some sort of professional to go, hey, what would it be? I don't know. But, you know, that's what the makeup guy's for. But then there was no... I mean, there was talk about it afterwards, but it was quite human. Like, his reaction when he could finally talk to... talk to Mr. Orange. He's in, like, so much pain, and he's freaked out about it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was funny that he's talking about that while he's lying there dying.
Yeah. Those two, like... Yeah, when Mr. Orange snaps and is just, like... swears at him. He's like, I'm deformed. He's like, dude, I'm dying here. I'm literally dying. Like, shut up. They're gonna come and help.
Yeah,
it's gonna be okay. And like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, it has purpose. It absolutely has purpose. Like, even the scene where you see a little bit of their escape and Mr. White shoots the police officers in the car with the two hands in the gun.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's really cool. He's got the two. And then it cuts to Mr. Orange and just the horrified look that he has on his face, because Mr. White, who he has kind of built this relationship with since they started planning this heist, just watching his colleagues get murdered. And just you can see the conflict on his face.
Yeah. He's such a nice guy, Mr. White, apart from the fact that he shoots people. Police officers, no real people.
Yeah.
Remember that line? Yeah. Mr. Pink is like, so who'd you shoot? Just a couple of cops.
No,
oh, so
no
real people.
No real people, yeah.
There was a nice...
Again, this movie is ahead of its time.
Snuck in line there. To show that there is some sort of line that they will not cross.
Yep.
A victim is a civilian. A policeman is the enemy.
Yep.
Which is, okay. No, any kids watching this, that's not the case. But, you know, it was kind of weird that they have this sort of morality, and that Mr. White is just so nice. He becomes this real nice big brother, father figure, you know. Come on, are you a doctor? Don't be an idiot. That's totally a dad thing.
Remind me or again.
An
are
uncle,
a doctor?
You know. Yeah, that was good. I really fell in love with Mr. White's character and his values of everything, and even how he cares for Mr. Pink afterwards. He offers him a cigarette. He's like, come on, wash your face. And be cool. Are you cool? Be cool. Nice little foreshadowings happening for other films, which I'm guessing we're going to talk about.
Probably.
They'll drop in. I wonder how much of this film influenced his writing of other films, or how much this film was kind of a testing ground for some of his themes.
Well, now's a good chance while we're here. If you'd like to, we can jump into talking about Tarantino himself and kind of lead up to this. And then before we go to What About When, we'll probably just touch on a few other things if we've missed them, which there are numerous things to talk about with this film. But no, Quentin Tarantino. So at the time of making this film, he was working in a video store with a good friend of his, Lawrence Bender, who you'll see that name pop up as a producer on the film. And he's 28 years old when he starts making this
Tarantino.
Movie. Yeah. Which, just if that doesn't make you feel unaccomplished, nothing will. I know, right?
Yes, no, I would feel that.
Yeah. So he wrote a bunch of scripts and was pitching them around. He wrote Natural Born Killers, and he wrote True Romance, which ended up being going on directed by Tony Scott.
Mm.
And Natural Born Killers was Oliver Stone. And then he wrote Reservoir Dogs. And when he was shopping it around, it had written on the front of the script, written by and to be directed by Quentin Tarantino. Like, it was not for sale unless he was going to direct it. Like, he knew that if he sold this to a studio, they'd just bastardize it.
Yeah.
And that's not what he wanted for his great piece of art. And I love that. He also was going to make the film with his friend Lawrence for $30,000 with a 16mm camera, where Lawrence was going to play a cop and he was going to play Mr. Pink, and it was just going to be like a chase through the street, essentially, with the diamonds. Like, that was just going to be the film that they were going
to
make.
Were they going to chop it up and go backwards and forwards to before?
Well, they didn't have the
after.
Budget. Like, it was, I have no idea what it would have been, that version. I'm sure it would have been great, but it would have nowhere near have been the masterpiece that it is today.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Lawrence Bender gave the script to his acting coach, who was friends with the wife of Harvey Keitel.
As you are, as no, you would be.
Sorry, I got it wrong. Lawrence Bender's acting coach's wife was friends with Harvey Keitel.
Not Harvey Keitel's wife.
No. Harvey Keitel's wife had nothing to do with it.
Acting coach's wife was friends with Harvey Keitel.
Yeah, and so she got the script and gave it to Harvey Keitel, who read it, called Tarantino, said, I want to be a co-producer. Let's try and get some money. And they ended up raising $1.5 million, a little bit more than the $30,000, and taught him how to do castings. And it was incredible. Okay, so yeah, that's why I said, without Harvey Keitel, this film does not happen. And Quentin Tarantino might not exist. He might have just been a blip on the radar.
How many films is Harvey Keitel in? How many Tarantino films? I only know two. But he's in
He's in a few. His voice appears in Inglourious Basterds on the other end of the radio. When Brad Pitt's character calls back home. He's obviously in Pulp Fiction.
The Wolf.
As the Wolf.
Mr. Wolf.
So cool. He's probably in more... Yeah, I can't think of any.
I could look it up. I'm not going to look it up.
No, that's I know really he's definitely in three.
So Tarantino would be indebted to Harvey Keitel.
Massively. And sings his praises constantly and will actively say, without Harvey Keitel, I don't exist.
Wow.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Oh, what a cool guy.
Absolutely awesome, right? Wow. But yeah. To be directed by Quentin Tarantino. Also, in case you weren't aware, Quentin Tarantino knows more about film and cinema than almost anybody on the planet. Like, he would have forgotten more about cinema than I will actively ever know, ever in my life.
I have a feeling he'd be at, have I said something like this before? He'd be at like a savant level of knowledge.
It's crazy. And music as well. He's like that with music too.
Yeah.
It's just, there's just something about the way his brain works. And it probably has a lot to do with the way he was brought up. Like, his parents loved taking him to movies, even when he was like essentially a baby.
Mm.
Like, I was listening to an interview with him this week. And what was it that he went and saw when he was like 4 years old or 5 years old? I can't remember, but it was like,
Oscar.
Hey, it's my puppy barking in case anyone's just having a bit of a growl. It's tired and he wants to go to bed.
He's been walking around a bit, if you've heard him. He's sniffing and scratching.
And, I don't remember what the film was, but it was something that like a child probably shouldn't go and see, a real hyper-violent film. And he's like, oh, no, it was fine. Like, parents didn't care. He's like, I learned to respect the cinema from my parents, that it was a place that this is adult time now. And if I want to be cool and fit in with the adults, I've got to be cool.
Ooh.
And just sit in my seat.
That's awesome. And,
yeah, right?
Oh, he should talk to my kids.
Right, he should talk to every kid. Yeah, just be cool in the cinema, people. It is a place to enjoy a film, not to be on your phone, not to run up and down the aisles. Just chill and let the experience wash over you.
Cinemas for kids are like playgrounds at nighttime.
It's awful.
They're so cool.
Yeah.
No. My kids love running right down the front. I remember them doing that, and they got to the front there. Hey, Dad! And I was like, oh, sinking.
Like, if I go to a kid's film, I get it.
Okay, yeah, so it was a kid's film.
I understand, that's fine. But like, there's a certain age that you get to where it's like, sit down, get out.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, kids' films, you don't go to watch the film. You got to take your kids to a film so they can play in movie chairs.
Yeah. But no, yeah, so the lead up to making this film, from being a nobody sleeping on your friend's couch.
Wow.
To then pretty much overnight success, where he took this film to Sundance. And I'm not sure whether it was at Sundance or another film festival. I think it might have been Sundance, where he stopped the film because it wasn't being projected correctly. They had the wrong lens on the projector, so it was cutting off certain parts of the film, and he just stood up and went, nah! Turn it off, get the right lens. I need people to experience this film. There was also, I think, a power outage happened as well during one of the first screenings. And yeah, he said it was just a total crap show.
Wow.
Yeah. And they did it again like the next week or something, and it blew everyone's minds.
Oh, geez, lucky you did that.
Yeah.
Well, imagine the balls you'd have to have to stand up, especially your first film. I'd be cowering, going, oh no, it looks wrong. Oh no, that's the end. That's the end. Good on him.
Yeah, right? Good and, on but him. That, but that's so him, though.
Look, I reckon he does have a massive ego, but it has worked for him with everything. And when he knows to let something that's going to be better than what he thought it was going to be come along, he will let it, like Steve Buscemi. I don't know if that was a first film thing, because first time directors, first films, it's almost like that is the biggest their ego will ever get.
Yeah, right.
So I think he does have one, but there are a few times where he knows where to keep it in check. Oh,
absolutely.
But look, he does know more than pretty much anyone. So, you know, who are you to tell me how to do that? I know that this is going to work. So fair enough.
I was going to find a point to jump in when you have an ego that's that big and also that merited, like he's earned it, honestly. He can be egotistical when you are literally one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet about the art form that you're in.
No, that's fair enough.
Like, it's fine. I mean, sure, humbleness is great, and I'm not a big fan of ego. I think it's kind of gross. Tarantino can get away with it in my mind. He's so good at what he does that he's earned it.
You're all right, Quentin.
Yeah, as long as you're not being like an ass to anyone, actively being aggressive.
He's not like that.
No, I wouldn't. I don't think so.
I hope not. Don't be like that. He's not. You're not. Yeah. This is your month, mate. You better be all right.
He has a high respect for his actors and his crew. And
That's good.
Yeah, he always brings back the same people again. He loves working with them, and he's got a mantra on set where, apparently he's got this fervent energy that if it's ever like you're filming late at night and you take after take and it's just not working out, he just brings out this energy in everyone. Wow. Being like, we get to make believe for a living. Like, how cool is this? And he'll say, we're going to do one more take. Why? And the entire cast and crew all shout at the same time, because we love making movies. He's like, cool, we're going again.
Wow. That's really cool. That's what a director does, right?
Yeah.
The director has to bring it out of everyone.
Yeah, so respect. Mad respect for the man. Well, that's cool. We've got heaps of time. We were supposed to go into What About When.
Well, let's...
I'd love to talk about the characters then while we've got a chance. I didn't think we'd get a chance to talk about them. So we'll do a quick character segment on the fly. This is fun. I have no notes.
Well, who should we talk about first?
Oh, Mr. Pink or Mr. Orange or Mr. White or Mr. Brown or Mr. Blonde or Mr. Blue would be fantastic. Or Eddie. Nice guy Eddie. Or Joe. Or... yeah, any of those characters. Any of those characters.
All right, Mr. Pink.
Mr. Pink, Steve Buscemi, good. We spoke about him a little bit already.
Yeah.
Smartest man in the room, I would say, by far.
Yeah, not the most courageous.
No. He doesn't really have any leadership qualities.
No.
To have people follow him, but he's the ideas person.
So what do you think the moral of this story was to let him run away with the diamonds at the end? And get away.
I think having the smartest person in the room be the one to survive.
Not the nicest.
No.
Not the strongest. Not the most
assertive.
Cutthroat.
Yep. Not the most masculine.
Lunatic.
Yep. Although he probably ended up getting arrested and he got the death penalty at that time.
Yeah, because the place was swarming with cops, right?
Yeah, so he probably didn't survive anyway.
He just ran into the arms of the police. Mm.
I like to think that he escaped. I don't know how, but I like to think he escaped with the diamonds.
Yeah. And then the bag of diamonds morphed into a black briefcase
that popped
up in the next film.
Maybe. Yeah, I'll talk about that. I'm really excited to talk about that. But no, Mr. Pink, in incredible forms. I think, for me, he gives the best performance.
Yep.
Oh, Mr. Orange. They're really good. Honestly, Harvey Keitel's performance leaves me a little bit lackluster. There's a few lines that seem a little bit red rather than...
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he plays a softie as well, and he's meant to be real hard ass.
But there's a line where Mr. Pink is having a go at him for telling Mr. Orange his name.
Yeah.
And he goes on this, "What was I supposed to do? The man was dying in my arms. Was supposed to say I'm sorry, it's against the rules." He just, the way that he yells at him the first time, just, it sounds a bit wooden.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry, Harvey Keitel. You are a genius and you're amazing, but yeah, there's...
I didn't say it.
There's a... I would never say that. It's just that particular moment and I'm like, He's acting.
Look, I kind of agree.
He's not in the scene. He's acting.
But I kind of see that with a few of his things. And I let it slide because there are people that are like that. Like,
yeah, true.
There are people that when you talk to them, you're like, why are you talking so weird?
Yeah.
And he is quite caricatured as well. Like he has this personality that is just like, what, do you really talk like that? But that's, you know, things like that. He's got this incredibly rough, rusk voice as well. He's got a really cool characterization that is natural. So I think whenever they're, you know, similar to like Christopher Walken, you know, his patter of speech normally is just very different to anything you'd ever hear, but it's also just the way he speaks.
He's so cool.
Yeah,
we'll talk about him at some point.
I guess we will.
Yeah, of course. How could we talk about Tarantino and not talk about Pulp Fiction? That would just be... Ugh, God, could you imagine?
All right, so Pink.
I talked about Pink. Mr. Orange is probably the most complex character out of the entire cast of characters. Because he's the one he's the rat, right? He's infiltrating. There's a couple of really interesting nods in the writing that he is the person who is the police officer right in the dining scene. Where it's the tipping scene, right? Mr. Pink hasn't tipped. Joe comes back and he's like, who didn't tip? And Mr. Orange rats him out.
Yeah.
Ooh. He's the, right? Whoa, mind blown. So he's like, Mr. Pink. And it's just a throwaway thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you like take a step back, he's ratting him out. He's the rat. I've just blown Terrence's
mind.
What
a tell.
I know, right?
What an idiot.
I know.
I mean, he doesn't get busted.
Yeah, but his performance is incredible. Like him as the cop and as the criminal undercover is just insane. And no one rides around in pain in the backseat of a car like Tim Roth does. I've
never seen anything like that.
It's insane.
He's squealing and crying.
Kicking the seat.
Yeah. I mean, that's another one that I wonder. I'm like, if I was in that much pain, would I be? You know you're going to lose blood. You know you should probably not move around a lot. Like,
I would say that because he immediately shoots. He gets shot, shoots the woman.
Yeah.
Has the realization that he's just shot a bystander.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it's a psychological panic as well.
Straight in the backseat of the car and they're driving to the warehouse, which is probably not that far away. So this is probably right after he's gotten in the car. Fresh blood is everywhere and he's just adrenaline. And he's still in shock. He can't believe that she killed him is some of the line that he says. And all the blood's just scaring the crap out of him. And oh, it is incredible. He's so scared. He's so scared in that scene. It's awesome.
Yeah. You learn very quickly that he's learned Mr. White's name.
Yeah.
Because he says Larry. I'm dying. I was trying to take note of whenever we hear a real person's name as well. It didn't go well. I got too wrapped up in the film.
Yeah, it's hard to take notes during this one. And the phone goes down.
Diner scene was awesome.
Yep.
Madonna, great. No notes.
Credits.
Damn it. What did I do?
Put the lime in the coconut. You're like, what happened?
And he's the first. He's not the first. What's the first line you hear in the film? It's Tarantino talking about
Madonna.
Madonna, right? Yeah. But then it's almost like a pre-credits section, because then after that we get into the walking to the car scene.
Oh my God. The epitome of cool. Yeah.
Iconic. And that song.
Yeah.
That the little green bag has been in my head and out of my mouth for the last week at work. Honestly, it's been hard to you know, even before that, so to keep it a secret, and because people at work know what I do, I'm thinking, doo, 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 doo. Oh, that was a coconut song. But and I walk past someone and I'm humming the little green bag, and they look at me like, no, nothing.
But no, just if you want to make your like characters look cool, just get Tarantino to direct them, like that slow motion walk to that music. There's a bonus feature on the version that I own. And it's got interviews with a whole bunch of critics and stuff. And one of them was like, Tarantino has turned these people into gods.
Oh, yeah.
Turned the characters into gods. Like that music, that slow-mo, like instant god status for cinema.
I watched a film when I graduated high school, and it was made by some amateurs. It was made by the kids in my grade 12 class, and it was the end of year video. And they used that scene.
Of course they did.
I had not seen the film. The film had only come out a couple of years before. Wait, when was this done? 94? 92. Okay, so a few years prior. I hadn't seen the film yet. So I'd just turned 18. These guys obviously had, and they made an homage to it in their own style. And I was watching our grade 12 farewell video thinking, this is so cool. Yeah. What a cool song.
these people are creative geniuses.
I watched this film in, I think, 99 or 2000 like, for the first time.
Bastards stole it. You stole it.
I'm like, what? Who's around me that knows what I'm talking about? No one here. Oh, my God.
That's hilarious.
I just think it's... Now I look at those guys that made the film, I'm thinking, wow, how did you watch that film? Like, you were...
That was me...
You were underage.
That was me watching The Shining and for the first time when we recorded the Shining episode. And I was just like, oh, that's what this the movie's from.
All these references.
Yep.
And the same for the Stuck in the Middle song. And I'd heard that for years before, listening to a lot of friends' tape in a car over and over and all these road trips. And then I see this film and that song was always just a bit of a weird pop song. I'm like, why are they listening to this in this mix of other things? Holy moly. Not only did I not know it was in the song, not only did I know it wasn't in the movie. No, I didn't know it was in the movie, but I had no idea the weight
that carries.
This song carries culturally. I had no idea. None.
Yep.
Boom.
This is why we left time at the end, by the way. We're still apparently talking about characters.
Sorry.
For Reservoir Dogs. No, we're both doing it, so it's fine.
It doesn't matter. Well, maybe that leads to Mr. Blonde.
Mr. Blonde. Michael Madsen is awesome in this movie, and he really butted heads with his character as well. So he's a pacifist, not violent in any way, and he found it quite difficult to shoot a lot of the scenes for this character, to the point where they had to stop filming during the torture scene because he was having a little bit of a hard time getting to where he needed to be.
Psychotic.
Yeah, playing that real kind of like zero empathy, dead behind the eyes.
Yeah.
Person
having fun too. He was enjoying it.
Yeah, which would be so hard to do for anyone. I'd imagine, but yeah, he did it so well. And Tarantino just directs the hell out of his actors. Like I don't know what he does. Whether it's just the atmosphere he creates on set, or the notes that he gives, or just the backstories. Like whatever it is that he does, he gets the best performances out of the actors that I have seen any director do ever.
Yeah,
it's insane.
And I think a lot of that does come from earlier you were saying about how he writes a backstory for every character. He has to. And any good writer does. But he creates these backstories that are totally totally personal, that you can relate to instantly. I don't think it's full of highlights. Oh, you did this and you did this. But it's like, here, this person has a dog. And this person, you know, the dog once got run over.
He knows
and
all that. Pain is it's crazy. There's a slight spoiler for The Hateful Eight. You'll be fine with this one. But just in case, Channing Tatum is in the film in a very small role and for a brief moment. And he was in an interview with one of the late night shows on in America. I don't know which one. And he was talking about how Tarantino directs and how he establishes the characters, because normally you would create, as an actor, you would create a backstory and you've got moments to fill in the blanks. But he would ask Tarantino, being like, oh, my character obviously led a previous life and has been reincarnated into this character, he just made this up, like the previous life that this person led, like what suit were they buried in? And Tarantino would be like, this one, like he goes that deep in his characters. Like, wow. He knows the moment they were born, every day they led to the day that they die, and we're just showing a couple of days in the life of this person, but he knows every detail on either side of those days.
Yes, and he'd have to.
Oh, it's awesome. That's he takes he such good it. Care of his actors.
That's how he gets these actors to create their own personality.
They're so real.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah. So good. I think that's probably how he helped Mads. Not Mads.
Madsen, Michael Madsen.
Michael. I was thinking Mads Mikkelsen. Yeah, Michael.
Yeah. What was the scene? You said there was...
Oh, the cutting off the ear and the throwing the petrol on.
Okay.
The scene. There was a moment where the actor playing the police officer is screaming, you know, don't do this. And he ad libs a line that wasn't in the script, and he says something to the effect of, "I've got a kid at home, or I've got a son at home," and
yeah,
Michael Madsen had just become a father quite recently, and it impacted him in a way that he just sort of shut down and had to leave. He's like, "I can't do it anymore." In fact, apparently, there's a version of this film that exists on Filmprint somewhere. There's an edit where you can actually hear someone in the background, and it's believed to be Tarantino himself, when that scene is happening, and you hear the actor say, "I've got a kid at home," you hear Tarantino in the background say, "Oh, no, no, no," before the cut actually goes off, because he knew exactly what it was going to do to Michael. Yeah.
Yeah.
Horrible.
If you... After becoming a parent, anything to do with kids, anything... You just turn into a blob of jelly. Yeah. You can't function anything. You hear a kid screaming for whatever reason, even if it's of joy, immediately, yeah, your hairs stand up on the back of your neck. It takes a while before that gets out of your system. A long while.
Yeah, you can imagine.
Oh, that's a tough one. If you're around someone and you say something and someone says, "Oh, look, I've got kids." Yeah, give them that respect, because that hit them in a place you will never know.
Yeah, so Tarantino was obviously able to get him back, walk him back into the scene and finish it off. But it almost shut that whole scene down from ever being filmed.
And probably one of the most famous scenes
of the entire film.
Not only of the entire film, of many, 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 many films. If you say what's the favorite scene in any film, or the most groundbreakingly shocking or something like that would be up there.
Yeah, it's one of those things where there's a particular meme being like, you can't hear pictures, and then people will put a picture up of something that you'd be like, "Oh, I recognize that." Like, if you put a picture up of him like throwing, like dousing the police officer, you hear the music.
Yeah.
You instantly or if you hear the song on the radio, or you're listening, you're streaming music, and you hear that song, you think of that scene if you have seen this film. Like, they are so synonymous with one another. Yeah, it's so ingrained.
Maybe it's a thing to do with the age of the song, that because it's such an old song, I don't even know when it came out, but to hear it out of context.
Well, it would have been in the 70s, right? K Billy's Super Sound of the 70s.
Keep on trucking.
Keep on trucking. Oh my God, we've been doing keep on trucking jokes for the last couple of episodes, seeing if anyone would pick up on it.
Stephen Wright.
Yeah, the voice.
K Billy Super Sound of the 70s.
I couldn't do it. I wouldn't even bother trying. I tried. We played around with the idea of like opening the episode, this episode, with being like, "Hello, welcome to the movie," and we couldn't do it. It wouldn't happen.
You can't. He is the one and only.
Yeah,
he's the one and only. What a great soundtrack. Can't do it. Great soundtrack. It's brilliant.
Characters. Oh, that's. I'm alright with that. Like, Nice Guy Eddie's great. Joe is just this monster of a human,
and they put at his big desk, probably a big mahogany solid wood desk, he's got big mammoth tusks, like
that's what it looks like.
Geez, a great little bit of set design. I love how they go into the little bro fight, you know, and Nice Eddie starts taking his jewelry off while they're talking. Like,
we're getting into moments. That's now, really cool. So it's probably a good time to jump into what about when.
Is it really?
I think so.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Let's get a taco. Okay.
We're going let's into it, straight then. Into it. So here we are, Reservoir Dogs, episode 26? 7? 6?
We've had 5. It on the screen before.
I have no idea.
And it's in the title of the episode when you click
whatever it is. We're here, we're doing hashtag what about when. The best way to contribute to this section is through Twitter or Instagram. We are at The Movie Cal. You can send us an email as well if you like, to themoviecal@gmail.com. It's a good way to give feedback and give us a list of awesome things about films that we're going to be talking about.
Including like suggestions for films coming up in January.
Yes, because we have no idea which ones we're going to do at this point.
If you don't, that's all right. We'll work something out.
We'll be okay. But if you have anything you want us to talk about, let us know.
And also, we have a website, themoviecalendar.com, where you can see a list of all the movies we've done. And there are links on the site to every episode as well.
Yeah.
But subscribe on YouTube as well and follow us on Instagram. Do all that kind of social media stuff.
Yes, please. So no hashtag what about when's from when's. Social media for me this week. How about you?
Not from socials, but I'll see. By the time by the time I edit this and put it out, you might have some. I might put them on the screen. How embarrassing if we don't. I'll put nothing on the screen right here.
That's fine. I'm okay with that. Did you want to start us off with a what about?
Yeah, okay. What about when... What about when Mr. Blonde tortures the cop?
Yeah, that's my number one as well.
It has to be.
I've literally just got hashtag what about when ear hacked off is what I've written down.
Well, I've got no idea what you're talking about there. Yeah. Mine was much more descriptive. Oh,
it's from a Simpsons episode, an Itchy and Scratchy episode. Have you seen that one?
No.
There's an Itchy and Scratchy cartoon where it's a Itchy and Scratchy special guest director, Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got the mouse like throwing petrol on, and like one of its ears is cut off and on the floor as well. It's the details are great. And then it's got Tarantino himself coming to the scene being like, "So with this scene, I'm really just trying to show that violence is not cool, man." And
what a great kids show.
Yeah, I know. It's so funny.
Far, I can't believe we watched this as kids.
That's a what about when. That whole thing is just so harrowing. But there's also humor in there as well.
Well, like weird humor.
He's like talking into the ear, being like, "Do you hear that?" Throwing it away.
Funny.
Yeah. Hilarious.
Hilarious. I like how he intros the radio as really plays and he goes, "You ever listen to K Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s? Does he say it? He says something about it, right?
Yeah.
Great way to put music in, get all your characters to love it and play it when they do weird things.
Awesome
and,
scene.
And one shot.
A huge from, one take.
From...
After he cuts off the ear.
After the ear cuts.
Throws it down.
Walking out to the car.
Stay here.
Coming back in and the sound dropping when he shuts the door of the warehouse behind him. Go to the car. Beautiful. Mixing in the natural sound. Yep. Just...
Actually Michael Madsen's car, by the way. Because they didn't have a budget for a prop one. So that's actually his car. Also, a lot of oh my god, the cast, the actors, a lot of them were wearing their own clothes because they didn't have a wardrobe budget. So
their own clothes?
Yeah, so Sean Penn, his like tracksuit, that is his tracksuit. Steve Buscemi is wearing his black jeans they're actually his jeans for the entire
film. So there was no like wardrobe, they just went, they would have, just look, we'll supply the ties and the jackets.
Yeah, the ties and the sunnies and stuff, but wear like, your own a lot white of them shirt. Just wear their own, they all wore their own stuff.
Wow. Okay, that's really cool.
Which is fun.
I like that.
Yeah.
What about? But you're right there, Oscar. Shaky, shaky. Yeah. sorry. I don't know how loud that was.
It's pretty loud.
It threw me a bit. What was that? I didn't see him walking in. When he walks out to his car, not that scene, but when he says to them all, "Hey, I've got something to show you. You'll like it." What about when? What about when he opens the boot?
A shot from inside the trunk of the car, I guess we should call it.
The boot, the trunk.
The boot.
Boot is the trunk here in Australia. Reminiscent of what we're about to see with Tarantino's work, Pulp Fiction.
A lot of repetition in his shots.
Opening up scene. I like that, watching this again, going, "Oh, look at that.
It was a cool shot.
Yeah.
I've got a hashtag, what about when we get introduced to these characters in the diner scene where they're just having a chat to each other about seemingly nothing, but yet we learn so much about them.
Yeah, how good is it? They're so nonchalant about what they're about to do.
Yeah, that whole scene is just unreal. The guy who plays Mr. Blue, Eddie Bunker, was a real criminal or ex-criminal in a previous life before he became an actor.
And why he was used
here? Yeah, pretty much. And he said that there is not a chance that a bunch of thieves who dressed that distinctively would be seen in daylight before doing a heist that would be that easily recognized.
No.
And I think that's hilarious. That because, like, who cares? They just look so cool.
What do they look like? They were all wearing black suits, white shirt, skinny tie.
Yeah.
Oh, there's one of those guys.
Yeah. Those people.
That's
cool. But that whole scene is just magic and just sets you up for a film unlike any other. Like, it lets you know that you're in for a ride that you've never been on before.
Camera's always moving, always low. These characters are... These are low people. There are no morals here. They've got values, but they're not moral values. Except for Mr. White, where he cares for this guy. I love that opening scene as well. It was really cool. All right. What about when... Mr. Orange is writhing around in that car. right early.
Brutal.
And it comes in over the top of the little green bag. After we get our intro shot of them walking, little green bag is still playing while the rest of the titles are being shown, the producers and everything.
And you hear him.
You start to hear him screaming very faintly.
And you're like, what is happening?
Is that a puppy?
And then flash.
Boom.
Blood. White car. Yeah. Man writhing in pain.
What other films are there where there's lots of blood on the interior of a vehicle?
Pulp Fiction.
Oh my goodness. Marvin?
Oh man, it's the name of the guy, right? We're not talking about that film yet.
Marvin's the cop.
Stop it.
Marvin's the name of the cop.
Yeah, that scene's incredible. We talked about that in the full episode. Him riding around in the car, just harrowing. Yeah,
that was
wild. Hashtag what about when Tim Roth, I should say Mr. Orange rather, or Freddie Noondike, I think is his actual name.
Sure. I think Freddie, we hear Freddie.
Freddie Noondike
is
his name. When he tells the commode story. And it shows the story being told over like 3 or 4 time periods, as well as then you see him in the story telling the story.
Yeah.
It's that kind of cinematic language that I think had never been seen before that made people just freak out.
It was great how they cut it into the story as well. So we didn't have to hear the story multiple times.
Yeah. Yes.
You hear the beginning of the story. At the beginning of his learning it.
Yeah.
And as it goes through, he gets better and better until we're in the story. And then it shows...
And then he's like...
They create the visual of him being in the story as well.
I love it so much where he's just... So I had to go to the bathroom and then... Whoosh, and then we're in the story. Like he has lived this story now. He knows it so well. And there's the cops in there telling their own story.
And, oh my God, they're telling a story.
And then he's telling the story to the police. Panic hits me like a bucket of water. Oh, it's excellent. Awesome directing and writing and acting and everything comes together. Editing. Sally Menke is an editor I have not mentioned. She is just a treasure. Rest in peace, Sally. You are sorely missed.
Wow. Did she edit for Tarantino again?
Yeah, like his first like 4 or 5 films.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. All the way up to Inglourious Basterds. And then she passed away. And then Django Unchained was edited by someone else.
I wonder if she had a big play in the time jumping of the edits.
Well, it all would have been scripted, but yeah, she would have helped to put it all together. Absolutely.
Well, she would have put it together.
Literally.
In terms of the idea of it and how that plays with the timeline and the pacing.
Yeah, I don't know.
That'd be really interesting. Because she may have, because the story changed quite a lot, right? When they got a lot of budget in.
Well, he had a full feature script already.
Okay.
But before the budget changed. But yeah,
I guess she would have made it totally work. You can't just cut these things together. You need the perfect timings. You need the perfect moments. I have one more what about when. Now, this is full of what about whens. But my last what about when is what about when they all shoot each other at the end?
Yeah, the standoff.
The standoff and...
Mexican standoff.
Joe shoots Orange and White shoots Joe and Nice Eddie shoots White and... And who shoots Eddie? I don't
know.
Oh, is that a thing?
You figured it out.
It's the first time I've actually gone boom, boom, boom. Wait a second.
You were like, there's something missing here. Yeah. I was actually going to pose a question at the end of this episode, but I'll do it now.
I'd have to watch it.
So yeah, comment below.
Yeah.
Who shoots Nice Guy Eddie? He's the only character that doesn't have a gun pointed at him.
Doesn't White?
He's pointing it at Joe.
Yeah, but he shoots Joe and moves the gun across.
He might.
But I don't know if he made it to
Eddie. But Nice Guy Eddie's bullet thing that comes off him is the first to go. He gets shot first.
Is this if you slow down the scene. In filmmaking?
It's rumored, yes.
Yeah.
That his squib just went off early accidentally.
Yeah.
I like to think... Should I give my theory?
No. Wait for a podcast where you talk about movies.
Yeah, to me, I think Mr. Pink shoots him from under the ramp.
It's a great theory. Because
he sees that it's all going to happen.
It's like, I'm out of here.
And he does it, and then he grabs the diamonds and runs. That's probably not true. I think it might be Mr. White going bang, bang, and just the squib going off incorrectly. But yeah, I love the fact that... Like, I used to have a t-shirt that said, "Who shot Nice Guy Eddie?"
No.
Yeah, like years ago.
I want that shirt.
It's so good. I love it.
I'm going to buy some printing paper from some office supply shop that irons on a shirt.
And it's like just niche enough that people will be like, what's that? But people who know will be like, that's a great shirt.
Good question. It was Mr. Pink.
Yeah. Well, wow. Or Mr. White.
I have to watch that again. Damn it.
Yeah, I know.
I don't think Mr. White gets off a second shot though. Because I remember seeing it. I did watch it again. That scene specifically. And I don't think he made it all the way up. The gun was down too low.
Well, speaking of gun violence... hashtag what about when Mr. White finds out that Mr. Orange is a cop? Oh. And when I say finds out, I mean what about when Mr. Orange tells Mr. White that he's a cop?
Oh, and he just starts crying.
Yeah.
Starts weeping.
The sheer look of
you bastard
emotion on his face. That betrayal, absolute betrayal. Because we find out in the film that he thinks he's jinxed because he did a heist years ago. They found out that there was an undercover cop and they all just backed away and ran.
Mm.
Luckily, nothing bad came of it. But yeah, so when he finds this out, it is literally the ultimate betrayal and he just breaks down. Gun goes off to the side of the head and you know that it's coming. That end shot of him just right close up, crying in pain, bang.
Yeah.
Gone.
That was so good. I like how... Mr. Pink's character says, you know, where are you from? Does he know where you're from? He knows your name and where you're from? Great. You've got a rap sheet? Great. Yeah. They're going to find you. And then you see it play out later on. I got one of the guy's names. And he's like, cool, we'll find him. Like,
oh, he's a Brewers fan. That must be he's from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Bing.
Oh, it's so good. I thought, like, whoa, they're going to get him.
Yeah.
They're going to get the bad guys.
No, everyone. Everyone dies.
Yeah, but they'll get Mr. Pink. They get him outside.
Yeah, Mr. Pink gets to leave the warehouse at least. But no, that standoff
he gets the rotten prison.
Is unreal. That's it for my hashtag what about Wens.
Well, you said to me before we started the episode that you were going to talk about something that you didn't. You were going to speak about
there's probably so many things.
This is a heavily, heavily, heavily male cast.
Yes.
There's one female character that gets spoken about, not Madonna.
not a character, a real person.
She's a real person, but one character is...
Oh, I did say this, didn't I? Yeah, I know what you were going to talk about.
One character is a child who, how old do you think she was?
Yeah, we were going to do... you were supposed to do the what about when, which is why you didn't remind me.
Which what about when? I don't know.
When Mr. Orange gets shot in the car, you were supposed to do the what about when, and then I was going to lead into my story.
I did the what about when of him in the blood in the seat.
Yeah, but not getting shot. Doesn't matter. We can do it now. Yeah, so there's a...
Here I'm going, I don't know what I meant to do now. I can't remember that.
No, it's okay.
Do you mean when they stop the car?
Yeah, when they stop the car.
And the lady and gets the gun out of her glove box.
She shoots him and he shoots her back and then has the realization on his face of, I've just killed a civilian.
Yeah, okay.
So that actor, the actress, actor, the
in
woman
the, car.
The woman in the car,
yeah.
Is actually Tim Roth's dialect coach because he's not... American.
Yeah, he's British, right?
He's British. And so he had to have a dialect coach. And he was not a fan of the way that she was teaching him. She worked him too hard. And so he asked Tarantino, he's like, can it be her that I shoot in the car? Which I just thought was hilarious.
Does she know that?
Of course. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's awesome. I loved it. I had to add that piece of trivia. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, but I love that. He was just
funny.
He was worked so hard. He was just like, I hate this so much. He's like, hey, can I shoot? Can I shoot her in the film?
Oh my god. Yeah, sure. We'll just get to take her shoes off first.
Yeah, no. There's no feet shots in this film. So well done, Tarantino, for showing some restraint on your first film.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't sure if he was able to. You know, expose that side of himself yet. He wasn't confident enough.
Well, he certainly has now.
Yeah,
that's what I've got. Thank you for reminding me that.
That's cool.
Reminding me of that. That's great.
Two carjacking scenes. That one.
Yeah.
And then Mr. Pink's getaway.
Yeah.
When he gets run over. He gets hit and he totally smashes that car windscreen.
That scene had to be done timed with the lights in the street because they didn't have a budget for a police presence to be able to turn off to shut the streets down. So they had to time it, be like, okay, and go. And then so he got into the car and you see him look up at the lights before he goes because he has to make sure they're green. Otherwise, he could get seriously get into an accident in real life. So he's got to make sure that the light's green before he goes.
Isn't that interesting?
Funny. Yeah.
And then you see the shot through the back of the window when the cop is chasing him down through this intersection. To know that, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Because there were
there's so many little details.
There were
like
people
that.
Watching.
Yeah.
You know, where there always are when people do big city street filming, of course people are going to watch the action. But I noticed people looking at that. How many extras did they pay?
None. they're okay, pedestrians. Cool.
Paid extras get told not what to look, where to look.
Not to look, yeah.
At that running scene down the street, I noticed a certain car game passed a few times. That it's good that you mentioned it was quite low budget, even though they got some more film with more money in the budget with Cartel.
Yeah, but $1.5 million is nothing.
No, that's right.
Like, this is still a very independent film.
That just means you get to have maybe some food on set.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple of extra lights in the studio. But yeah, it was nice. And back to, I mentioned it in another episode where you can see movie magic and you can see what it takes to make a film. But when it goes past, you miss it. You only pick it up the third, fourth time you watch it and you think, very cool. Very cool. I like that. Like this looking up at the lights thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. Really cool. It's fun getting to know some of the behind the scenes stuff. It can enhance your experience. It can ruin the experience in a lot of examples, but
first time you watch it, I think it ruins them.
Oh yeah.
Because the movie magic is no longer magic.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell people that for the first time they watch it. Hi, if you're here and you haven't seen the film, congratulations.
I'm
sorry.
We warned you.
We did
warn you at the beginning. Go watch this.
But yeah, should we, I thought I had something else to say before we went on to the movie calendar. It's fine. There's lots that we're going to leave on the floor for this one, and I'm completely okay with that. We're going to be talking about Tarantino for the next few episodes anyway. So if there's anything that I've missed with regards to him, we can add it in.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything else really. I mean, there are a few other things that.
Yeah, but it's fine. We've done really well.
Yeah,
we're gonna add the film to the movie calendar. Reservoir Dogs. We had a date in mind for this film. We will say we had to go with an alternate date because the date that we were originally going to put it on was already taken.
So we would have broken the law.
Alas, we don't want to break cinema law
and
get arrested by the film police.
No,
but the original date that we wanted to put it on was the 21st of January, which is the date that this film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and changed the world of cinema forever.
We couldn't do that.
We couldn't do that because Get Out is on that date. If you would like to find out why Get Out is on that date, click on the card above and you will be able to see that information. But the date that we have chosen for Reservoir Dogs is December 14th.
Why, Lee?
So at the other end of the year.
Say that a lot, don't I?
And the reason why, like, you know, we talked about this. We came to the decision. It's written the.
I know, I'm pretending.
And the reason why is because. I was doing some research for this episode, obviously, because it's what you do. It's fun to research, and I like doing it. And I found out that on December 14th, only a few years ago, 2017, there was a software update added to a video game called Payday 2, where you could perform a heist on that day in Los Angeles of a jewelry store with the Cabot crew. Cool. Which is such a cool Easter egg. Obviously, it's Reservoir Dogs. And yeah, the fact that that came in on December 14th, I thought that was just a niche enough reference to put in there. And I love the idea of watching this film towards the tail end of the year, where you can enjoy some really good pieces of cinema.
That's about as niche as his shirt.
Nice Guy Eddie. Yeah, I've got to get another shirt like that. Cool. That's great.
I wonder if anyone watching this has played that update.
Yeah, I'm sure people have. People will discover this in the future and they'll know that.
If the characters wear black skinny black
suits. I don't know, but I do know that the heist takes part in the video game over 2 days and you play the second day first and then you go back to the first day in true Tarantino style.
Very cool.
Yeah, so that's awesome. So that's the date we've chosen.
Very cool.
December 14th is where Reservoir Dogs will sit on the movie calendar. As for the next few episodes, we announced in the Goonies episode last week that it is going to be Director December for Tarantino. So the next episode is going to be Pulp Fiction.
Mm.
So please make sure you get in your hashtag WhatAboutWhens or a date for the movie calendar for that one if you haven't. Haven't watched that one yet. So, no, I mean, I've seen it. I haven't watched it this week.
You watched it last week.
Could you imagine if I hadn't seen Pulp Fiction?
Oh, this would be cancelled.
Right, we'd have to stop. We'd have to shut down. And then after that, we are going to be doing Kill Bill Volume 1 and then Kill Bill Volume 2. Even though Tarantino calls them the one film, We're going to do them as two separate episodes because they deserve an episode each.
Yeah, cool.
And then after that, January?
We don't know. We'll announce
it. No idea.
When we work them out.
Let us know if you have any ideas. Again, Twitter, Instagram, email. Best ways to do it. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you learned something. I hope you had fun hanging out with us for a while. Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you, Lee.
Did you enjoy that?
I did. Keep on trucking.
Just keep on trucking. Thank you, everyone. And we will see you for Pulp Fiction.
Awesome. Cool.
Bye.
See ya.